Pitch Pong, where is that a call?
I'll contain myself.
This is quite an odd coincidence. And thanks, Pauline, for making this. So this is happy accident. We have Pauline and Dr. Jeff Smith from University of Wisconsin-Madison. Is that right? Yeah. And so I had talked to Dr. Smith a couple months ago. Can I call you Jeff, Dr. Smith?
Yes, please do.
He allowed me before the show. I just didn't want to sound rude to my listeners, our listeners. So I guess a couple months ago, I really liked your observations on Film Art on Red and also La Ceremonie. I would just love those. I like all of those, but that's just speaking to me. So I got to get this guy on the show and reached out to you, and we were both traveling a bunch, so figured, okay, well, we'll put this off to about mid-August. At that time, Pauline, as people might know you as Lady P from FlixWise.
Lady P. Hello, yeah, Pauline. I was going to ask you about why so informal.
Well, you were off in Europe, and then all of a sudden, I'd been waiting for you to get back and settled, and I was going to say, hey, Pauline, your turn. And then I heard you're going to grad studies at University of Wisconsin, and you're going to arrive around the same time. So here we are, Pauline and Dr. Jeff Smith. So hello.
Voilà.
Hello.
Hello. Bonjour.
Bonjour. Yeah. Did you have fun in Europe?
You know, I did, I have to say. Europe's pretty great, it turns out. Highly recommend. 5 out of 5 stars, I guess.
Five out of five. There you go.
Yeah. y'all should check out Paris.
Yeah, I've been there. It was nice. We did the before sunset thing. That was a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah.
So, Jeff, you are a... I guess you're going to be Pauline's Lady P. Are you Lady P or Pauline?
I'm Lady P. Come on.
You're
now.
Lady P. Okay.
Yeah.
This is a classroom dynamic.
Shattering
Wait a minute.
My facade.
I might be committing to calling you Lady P in class.
Please do.
From here on. So.
This is actually super exciting. So you're making this major life journey, and you're going to. And I was surprised because I know you worked at the Tennis Channel. So what prompted this decision?
Oh my God. Well, I'll be honest. Jeff and Co. had a lot to do with that decision. I'd been considering going to grad school for quite some time, probably a few years, and. It just came to a point where I decided if I'm going to do it, I got to do it now or I got to do it very soon. And so about a year ago, I started studying for GRE and thinking about what I would submit for writing sample and going through all that stuff. To my great shock, the University of Madison, Wisconsin decided that I was a worthy candidate. And, it ended up being between Madison and UCLA. And while Los Angeles is my hometown, and I will always be an Angeleno in my heart, the faculty at Madison just kind of blew everyone else out of the water. So
I get it.
Yeah.
I get it. So, I would be going myself. I'm going to live through you, I think,
sure.
as much as possible.
You're gonna be sensible and you've decided you value sleep.
I do, yeah. No, and I also like, I don't like cold, so.
Sure. Yeah, so, yeah.
Well, I think the jury is out on that for Lady P as well.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Wait till, starting fall, so we'll see.
Yeah. Ease on into it.
So, Dr. Smith, Jeff, you're a superstar. You're in fact, here, let me, I don't know if you can see me on camera, but I got to show you something. Show and tell. Can you see this?
I have to get.
That is Film Art.
Yeah.
You're not on this one.
Yeah, I'm not on this one. No.
It's an older one. So,
yeah.
You're now on them. That's
I am, yes.
For my old film studies class. Great textbook. Of course, I'm not going to rebuy it so I can read your contributions, although I'm sure they're wonderful. But you've been working at Madison for how long, or how did you get involved with Boardwell Thompson and crew there?
Well, you could say it's a story that stretches back at least a generation, because I did my graduate work here at UW-Madison starting in 1987. So, and David Bordwell was my advisor during my graduate school tenure. And trust me, Lady P is very well qualified to enter this program. Her writing sample, her GRE is all much better than mine. So,
did she submit a podcast episode for?
Oh, I should have.
No, she wrote a very good paper on the Bigabus. I mean, that was one of the. Yeah,
okay. I'm sure you'll be a tremendous student, Paul, Lady P.
Thank you. We'll see.
So, but I really did feel the faculty kind of took a chance on me, because I was not someone who had even taken a lot of film classes when I first started. So David, J.J. Murphy, Vance Kepley, Tino Baglio, they were all really important formative influences. I was, you know, kind of like moldable clay. And over the years, I had stayed in touch with David and Kristen, and, you know, it was a situation where I was very happy where I was at, which was Washington University in St. Louis. And some of my students would even say, like, is there any chance you would ever leave Wash U? And I would say, well, there's only one job out there I think that would attract me. And it happened to be the one I currently have right now.
You have an awesome job.
Yeah. And so in 2006, after being out of school for about 10 years and doing the kind of, you know, VAP thing at NYU and spending 7 years at Wash U, I had the opportunity to come back. And that was not only a great chance to experience this institution in a whole different way. I remember going into the History of World Cinema class, my first, I think it was the first class I taught here in 2006. And I said, well, you know, I may be one of the few people who can say I have experienced this from every possible position. I was a student in this class in 1987. I was a TA for the class in 1990. I lectured for the class in 1992, and now I'm a professor teaching the class. So
you every paid your possible.
Yeah. So it was a little weird in some ways to come back to some place that was so familiar, because I, you know, I knew all the faculty, and to suddenly be, you know, asked for my contributions as a faculty member for all these people who. You know, I was just a humble graduate student for all that time. But, you know, I certainly feel like it's been a great ride since I've been here. I look forward to finishing my career at UW-Madison. And no small part of it has been the opportunity to rekindle the friendship with David and Kristen, who, in fact, live only about two blocks away from me here in Madison. And they were in a situation where their publisher had approached them about doing maybe a kind of offshoot of film art. We used to kind of jokingly call it film art for dummies. And so I was kind of brought in at that point, not to work on film art as the flagship, but to try and do a more streamlined, somewhat simpler, a little bit skewing more contemporary version of film art. And once I had done that, the book ended up not really going anywhere. But once I had kind of shown that I could do that work, I think David and Kristen said, well, let's just have you come on to work on film art proper. You can ultimately take over for us, because as we get older, you know, we want to be able to gradually lessen our involvement. I think, you know, they're obviously very active bloggers and still very much leaders in film studies, but I guess, you know, David and Kristen are thinking about this. Do we really want to be doing this in our 80s? Probably will, yeah. But
I think
they want the, you know, freedom to have as much or as little involvement as they want. And so
absolutely get it.
Yeah.
Well, please tell David that his commentary on An Autumn Afternoon is one of my favorites ever. All his Ozu stuff is just tremendous. If I'm in Madison, I might ask to sleep on your couch because. I'm kidding.
Sure. We have a very large. I mean, you could bring a few of your friends if you like to. It's like we host Oscar parties every year, and.
Oh, nice.
And we kind of invested in getting one gigantic sectional that seats like 14 people just because we'll make everybody more comfortable for Oscar parties. Mostly it becomes a lounge for our cats, but...
Well, Wisconsin's really become, as you said, Pauline, between UCLA and Wisconsin, and I would say maybe NYU probably is a pretty big film studies program, but I think you, thanks to Bordwell Thompson and yourself, I think you've basically put it on the map. So, I'm not going back, but if I were.
But maybe come visit.
I might actually come visit.
I think you should.
Not in January, but yeah. Perhaps. No, actually, I have a friend of mine lives in Madison, so I hear it's beautiful.
Ah, yes.
So, well, I guess... usually we warm up a little bit, so I think we've kind of done that. But I guess we'll go ahead and start. Usually on the show, we just talk about what we've been doing lately. Jeff, do you want to start us out?
Sure. You had mentioned my work on film art, and right now that's kind of the big project for me for the next several months is we've started work on Film Art 12. In fact, on Wednesday, I'll be participating in a WebEx call with our editors at McGraw-Hill to learn whatever new system we're going to be using to update the textbook. So we've met collectively to kind of create a roadmap for what we see as at least the biggest changes that will be made to the text. And so my job at this point is that we had the brain trust meeting between David, Kristen, and myself is for me then to kind of implement those, because David and Kristen are still very hard at work on the next edition of film history. So, while they continue to work on that, I'll start work on film art, and that's kind of my big project for the next several months. I have a couple of other more, things closer to my research interests. I have a book chapter that I've been working on that is a response to the work of another scholar who has talked about what he calls a non-diegetic fallacy when it comes to the spatial relationship of music to the action on screen. I mean, in common parlance, we usually talk about the difference between score and source music. Mm-hmm. And he suggests that that may even be kind of like a false dichotomy, simply because film is not... a realistic medium. So why couldn't we imagine a fictional world in which the characters simply have music that's in the air?
Sure. That's and if listeners don't know, diegetic means in the scene or from the scene, and non-diegetic is external score.
Yes,
that sort of thing.
It's construed as something external to the space of the fiction.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I just have a lot of problems with that. Not necessarily from kind of philosophical perspective, in that sort of what if sense. Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah. There's no reason why a priori we would want to say this isn't a possibility, but I just can't imagine how anybody would understand any film if you don't bring some degree of real world knowledge to it. Mm-hmm. You had mentioned Red, and I've kind of gone back to that as an example to kind of counter the notion that we bracket everything we know. We check our brains at the door, and every piece of information we get about the world on screen is something hypothetically new to us. I just don't think that's the way viewers work. Mm-hmm. And I talk about the scene in Red where Valentine just pulls her car up to a stoplight. Now, this is the, one of the most routine sorts of actions you can depict in a movie. And yet, if we were to say, what if, we would have to ask like hundreds of questions about that mm-hmm. very simple action. Like, does her car have an internal combustion engine? Or is she operating it with her feet, a la Fred Flintstone? You know, it's, I mean, there are things like that that mm-hmm. we tacitly just accept. And I mean, most narratologists talk about this as the principle of minimal departure. David Bordwell has a more colorful way of describing it. He calls it the Philip Marlowe has lungs hypothesis, that, you know, we assume that, you know, a human agent in a film has a normal human physiology and all of the things that go with it. So I've been writing a kind of response that attempts to counter that idea that we, you know, that we would simply bracket our assumptions about where music is originating for any scene in a film. We have conventions. We understand those conventions. And to me, that's a perfectly acceptable way of thinking. But it's one of these things, you know, musicologists, and I spend a lot of time in, you know, talking to musicologists and a lot of conferences I go to. And I don't think they like the diegetic, non-diegetic distinction. So, period. Hmm.
That's interesting. Yeah. It was almost accepted when I was in school.
Yeah. And I think,
I don't know if it still is.
I think most film scholars still, you know, operate with that as a kind of tacit distinction in mind. But mm-hmm. But musicologists, for some reason, they feel like, you know, that somehow it doesn't really explain anything. And I guess the question is, well, it depends on the question you're asking. If it's just mm-hmm. simply an understood category that understands very conventionally, yeah, it's not terribly interesting, but it's kind of one we need. I think that's mm-hmm. my philosophy on it.
Yeah, it's kind of like the music equivalent of in a piece of literature, you don't show them opening doorknobs and going
right.
in. You have to skip a few steps that the audience just is going to be aware of, just being part of the picture. So anyway, well, we're jumping right in. This is the what we're doing part. So Pauline, what have you been up to?
What have I been up to besides moving across the country?
Yeah,
I guess. The biggest thing that I've done, film.
Lady Pete, sorry.
Lady Pete, please. well, you know, I've been podcasting, as per usual. The big one that I just put out recently was the Sunset Boulevard episode.
I missed that. Oh,
it's with Phyllis Nage. Anytime Phyllis Nage is on the show, it is a must listen. Phyllis Nage, for those who don't know, is the screenwriter of Carol, best movie of the decade. Viewers of Carol may recall that there is a scene in that movie where Therese goes to a movie theater, and they're showing Sunset Boulevard. And so it was fascinating to hear Phyllis's explanation for why she chose that film. It's basically her contention is that it's the perfect illustration of film subtext, which is basically what Carol is about. And just the whole discussion that she has, or all of the points that she brings up about that movie are fascinating. And it made me rethink that film. And I know, Aaron, mm-hmm. that's a major favorite of yours, right?
Yeah, I did some work on that in school too. But you know, as time passes, it fades a little bit.
Wow.
I could pick it back up, but it's probably been a good five years or longer since I've jumped into that one. But oh no, huge fan. And in fact, it was on Twin Peaks this week.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. it's still relevant.
Cecil B. DeMille. yeah, I was traveling, so I'm behind. But are you going to be able to keep podcasting from Madison?
Well, I hope to. I mean, that's partially up to the professors here how much they keep me bogged down in another
day. She said she's not going to sleep.
Yeah.
I figure that time's saved there.
Right,
that'll be podcasting.
I'm hoping to be able to continue podcasting. I'm sort of coming up with plans of, as about how I can maintain the schedule of the podcast and the schoolwork, and I'm thinking about maybe incorporating some of the schoolwork into the podcast.
Oh, nice.
That might be a good way to do both, which might mean jumping around the sight and sound list. But
I'm sure the listeners will love it.
Yeah,
be able to kind of again live through you.
Listen
through you. So.
Yeah,
the episode on Sunset Boulevard though raises a question I'd just like to ask each of you, which is. I can report, and this to me is not a very usual phenomenon. It's not very common, I should say, in my movie-going experience. But, you know, there is a phenomenon that music researchers, especially people who are psychomusicologists, people who combine hardcore psychology theory with music studies, talk about a, you know, musical chill effect. And I have to say, Sunset Boulevard is a film that when I see the final scene and the last line, I always get chills.
Yeah.
Goosebumps,
Goosebumps that go up and down my, you know, the chills go up and down my spine. Are there examples of that for each of you? Can you think of it?
Well, actually that's a good segue. So my thing, and I this is a pretty special thing, so as you all know, there was an eclipse today. We're recording this Monday. The show's probably not going to come out for at least a few days, or a couple days at least. So we're in the path of totality, so it was a big deal in my town. Big tourists, they attracted, they said up to 1 million, but I don't know how many actually showed up. And it was beautiful, by the way. If you can see a total eclipse, and that little, I know it sounds trite, that just, okay, it gets dark for a couple minutes, and then it's light again. But it was actually pretty overwhelming. But my local theater, the local indie theater here, they decided to put on 2001, a Space Odyssey as a way to celebrate and attract some of the astronomers. And they sold out 2 screenings. That's all they could do. And so I watched that again for the first time in a few years last night. And it's probably my 4th or 5th time. And that's one of those films that I think that just nails, you know, just the pairing images to music. So I definitely got chills and goosebumps. Just thus spake Zarathustra. Is that what it's called? It blows you away, and it was great. It was to see it with a young crowd too in a theater, and this is a university crowd, probably not too dissimilar to Madison, just a little further south. I could see kids going gaga about it. And this is a movie that's 50 years old, and it's just phenomenal. So I don't know. Do you have one of those, Lady P?
Sure. Sometimes it's hard to distinguish the feeling of the shock of a beautiful music score or a beautiful tone or whatever from the nostalgia that it evokes. You know, because nothing triggers that sentimental streak quite like a good score. But for me, I'm going to mention Carol again because I guess it's on the brain. But you knew it was coming.
Yeah.
But
Carol's great.
When Joe Stafford's You Belong to Me starts playing, I just lose it. I remember the first time I saw it, and that song came on, I was just like, you didn't do that. It was just cruel. How dare you?
You just kind of melted, huh?
I melted. I fell to pieces. Which is another song that does that to me. But
that may have been the music supervisor's other choice.
Very well then, basically.
Well, I kind of had stuff to talk about your background and your interest in academia, but we're kind of just going. But I guess we can use that. So Jeff, you kind of already went into your background, and I think that's fascinating, and it's an interesting approach to film from the perspective of music and sound.
Mm-hmm.
And back to the observation on film art, which I'd like to get back to. But you talked about La Ceremonie, Chabrol. And probably not enough people here have seen it. I don't think it's had a proper release. Have you seen it, Lady P?
I sure have. I love that movie.
Me too. In fact,
it's so good.
I don't know. I was kind of debating whether to call that a good Chabrol streak. I'd say it was an okay stretch, but that was certainly a peak, maybe of his career. But in that example, basically you have off-screen sound. I'm going to throw out the diegetic, non-diegetic.
Sure,
you have
yeah.
off-screen sound, including music that relates to the action going on in the frame. And I just thought that, and I'd seen the movie a couple times, and I just, of course, you know, when you get wrapped up in the narrative, and especially a thriller kind of like that, and waiting to see what happens, you kind of just don't think about these things. So can you just talk about how your music interest merged with your film interest, and how you took that plunge academically? I guess you kind of already did, but
well, there's actually more to it than that, because when I decided to go to graduate school, it was the last thing on my mind that I wanted to study. You know, my purpose statement, I think, said I wanted to study Japanese cinema, and my writing sample was on a documentary. So it was about as far from music and film as you could get. And having had the undergraduate music degree, I sort of felt like this was my opportunity to go in a completely new direction. And yet the faculty convinced me that I had a kind of unique skill set, in the sense that I could read music, I had a very solid basic understanding of music theory, and now I had 4 years of coursework in film studies. So the combination was something that would give me a real unique profile in academia. And it was very good advice. It was something that I wasn't convinced of until I had done a independent study with David Bordwell, where I go over to his house once a week, and we would have stuff that we had agreed to read. And it was supposed to be, you know, 15 weeks on film music, but there was so little of any quality scholarship on it that we ended up reading kind of a grab bag of other stuff on music and semiotics and music and opera. I mean, anything that we could get our hands on that would just kind of supplement the couple of academic books that were out there. And at the end of it, David had said, well, is this something you think you could write about? And what I kind of realized looking at what had been published was it was all very much focused on the golden age of the Hollywood film score. So really from 35 to 1955, the
Max
names,
Steiner.
Yes, the Steiners, Korngolds, you know, the early stage of Bernard Herrmann's career, all of that stuff was very much part and parcel of what had been objects of study. And I saw it as an opportunity for me to bring a knowledge and passion I have for American popular music to the table, and said, and there's nothing out there really on the 1960s. And this is a period in which all of those kind of old lions are being put out to pasture, so to speak, by the studios. Just not working very frequently, or in some cases, you know, Alfred Newman dies in 1970. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about period where there was a great deal of change and a kind of new generation of composers who would then themselves come to dominate the next several decades of film scoring in Hollywood and elsewhere. And so I thought that is something I would be interested in writing about. And so that's what took me into that world was, you know, I want to study how music really changed in Hollywood in the 1960s with this influx of new composers and people who were coming very much from jazz and pop backgrounds rather than, you know, so that was kind of the hook that got me interested. And I've been doing it on and off. It's one of those things. Once you establish a research profile. Mm-hmm. There's never any shortage of opportunities to continue working on that kind of stuff. I get invitations all the time for, do you want to contribute to this volume? Or, you know, do you have anything that you might want to submit to our journal, which we're just putting together? And you know, I kind of see myself at this point as being more of a film studies person than a film music person per se. So
but your last book was about the Cold War and the Black History. Yeah. So,
and people said, people would ask me, what does that have to do with music? And I would say, nothing.
You know, I think if I were a professional advisor, I think it's good for you to get out of that and you know, not be typecast, professor.
Right. Yeah. No.
But,
that was
still have your
kind
your
of
roots.
The reason why I yeah. wanted to do it. So I've always had this as a you know, a sideline. So I've continued to work and been very active in that community, and it has really been, I think, you know, for better or worse, it has been the basis of whatever reputation I've achieved in the field is, you know, one of the leaders in study of music and film.
Yeah, well, that's awesome. And I just, having gone through that, I don't remember that being much of a focus. Of course, they talk about, again, diegetic, non-diegetic, sound effects, Foley artists, that's always right. fun in class, that sort of thing. But yeah, I think to actually make it part of an academic study, especially now, you know, I haven't seen Baby Driver yet, but, you know, like Guardians of the Galaxy, they really incorporate popular music into the soundtrack. So yeah, I think it's becoming, and actually Tarantino too.
Tarantino is really a kind of master at doing it. Yeah. So much so, in fact, that I saw Atomic Blonde, which I quite liked. In fact, I'm kind of previewing maybe where our discussion was going to go for non-Criterion things. It's got a great soundtrack, except it uses cat people again. And the minute I heard those drum beats, I was like, no. Tarantino completely owns that now with Inglourious Basterds. You can't use it, but you know, it worked in its own way.
They do reuse a few waltzes here and there and that sort of thing. So Lady P, I kind of lost my train of thought. Well, I guess we should get into Criterion stuff. So, Lady P,
yes.
Obviously you knew Professor Smith, Bordwell, Thompson. So, I mean, have you read their stuff? And by the way, I don't know, if you know how to the film geek world, like Pauline and I think I've seen us both gush. do you guys realize? I segued from Pauline to Jeff. But do you guys realize how cool you are?
Basically, it's true.
Well, you know, for me, I still feel like, you know, I'm standing on the shoulders of giants because David and Kristen are so well known in the field, and I'm just happy to be, you know, have that association. I would not presume to be anywhere near their league in terms of the kind of quality of scholarship, the productivity. So,
you're not going to write Ozu Part 2?
No, I'm not. But, you know, it's funny that David and I frequently have lunch, and he will say always, he's like, you know, you give me the best ideas about, because, you know, we'll just talk about, you know, something he's having a problem with in conceptualizing, or, you know, just bouncing ideas off one another. And so I'll accept a muse type role. Sure.
Yeah, I'm trying to find a way to fit that back to Carol. But so Pauline, obviously,
yes.
You're gaga over this gang, right?
As all film nerds are. I mean, I think you mentioned this when the film art is basically the first textbook you get whenever you enter into the film studies milieu. It's just like, that is the textbook. So that, knowing that they kind of are the foundation on which this program is sort of built, and even knowing that they are now emeritus, it's still a long legacy, and beyond them, the remaining faculty, the people who run this place, who teach, who publish, are all just first rate, you know, truly leaders in the field. Yeah. Go ahead.
Can I ask what you enrolled in this semester?
Oh, well, we were given recommendations. So,
you haven't actually advised and all that?
I haven't. Well, we were, what my advisor said that I should take intro to film theory, intro to film historiography, I think it, that, and yep. then
okay.
And then French cinema. So
okay, nice.
Yeah, not bad.
Just the French cinema? No, no.
Yeah, no, no. As far as all of French cinema, I expect to be an expert in 4 months.
We can cover that in a couple classes.
Sure. I mean, all of film theory, frankly, sounds more daunting, but.
Well, that is two classes.
Yeah, okay, fair.
I think I've actually taken a class like that.
Okay.
It's not as intimidating.
Sure.
So, I'd like to tell my film art study or story. I didn't know that this was like the classroom film studies book text. Is it actually, or?
It's got to be one of them. It's you know, there's David Thompson and the two Davids. You end up reading one of them.
Yeah, well,
That's right. Thompson.
Yeah. It is used in our. You know, in our intro class for sure. And everywhere that I've taught, it's also been a, you know, the kind of intro to film studies text there as well.
So I think you'll appreciate this then. So this is an early edition. It's probably outdated now, but so I went to the bookstore. This was film 300. So this would not be, it must've been like 120 or whatever. I went to the bookstore. School started in 2 weeks. I had the textbook read by like in 3 days. I basically read it cover to cover, not the way you should do it. And then of course I showed up to class and you know I was that guy. Yeah. but no, I love what you do and I'm so thrilled for you, Lady P, to further your career. So can I ask? Do you know where the end game is? Are you going to become on Film Art edition 18?
I mean, yeah. I think Professor P has a nice ring to it, don't you?
Yeah. Professor P.
Yeah. P. Dr. P? Come on!
Yeah, no relation to Master P.
No relation to Master P.
Well, I was going to say, Professor P does sound like a, you know, a hip-hop handle.
Sure.
People will be rating you on your flow.
So. Or like a super team kind of character. So,
yeah.
And Lady P, I know I could see you being, you have a great voice.
You
articulate very well. I could see you doing something either in media or writing, or have you thought much about it? I know you just got to Wisconsin.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Right now, I'm trying to get through the first day of class. That's number one priority. But beyond that, you know, I would like to incorporate some of my podcasting passion, basically, and
sure. new media,
if at all possible. Yeah, if I could incorporate my whatever knowledge I can, whatever mm-hmm. knowledge I gain in this throughout my studies, it would be great if I could somehow also incorporate podcasting and new media and all of that.
I think there's a lot of room for in that discussion, just not just podcasting. I mean, that's one part of film social media these days, but film Twitter is a big deal. In fact, I have somebody next week who's a big part of film Twitter who's going to be fun. So,
who's that?
It's a surprise. I'll tell you after the show.
Okay.
It's somebody you know and think is very cool. Actually, I think you might know this person.
All right.
It won't hurt, in fact, that two of my colleagues, Eric Hoyt and Jeremy Morris, have just landed a major grant to support studying and preserving podcasts. So
that's very exciting,
it's part of our new media curriculum here.
I may be applying. I won't steal your thunder, Paul. Well, anyway, this is a Criterion podcast, and we talk about Criterion and Filmstruck, and so we're shelving that a little bit this week, no pun intended. But Observations on Film Art happened. I think we're about to be on episode 10, which I believe that's yours. The Ali Furates the Soul, is that?
It is indeed, yeah. It's the title is basically stripped down style, but it was, for me, it was a kind of opportunity to talk about a film that I've just enjoyed over the years, not just you know, as a viewer, but I find it an extremely rewarding film to teach. And so part of what I wanted to focus on is how Fassbinder created the film, really in a, you know, kind of whirlwind of creativity, where he needed to start on another film for which he had gotten a kind of subsidy. So he was kind of squeezing Fear Eats the Soul in to a schedule that was requiring him to begin his kind of passion project for Effie Briest at a certain point in time. And so there's almost this feeling that this was a bit of an afterthought, but I've always felt like it is a wonderful blend of what I think Fassbinder's great strengths are as a director. Early in his career, he could be, you know, very wild stylistically, as you see in a film like The American Soldier, or extremely controlled, like rigorously so, using a kind of rectilinear approach where everything is tableau, everything is very frontal, as you see in Katzelmacher, in which even the segments are kind of divided by these, you know, walk and talk two shots. And Fear Eats the Soul, certainly it retains some sense of that kind of discipline and control and how he approaches style. The performances are scaled back in some ways. There's, you know, the line readings can seem a little bit flat. There's this even a kind of stiffness to, particularly performance of El Ben Salim
Couscous.
That, you know, there's...
People have seen it will know what I'm talking about.
Yes, yeah. and yet, it's still an extremely engaging film emotionally. So it's kind of like the perfect blend of that early sense of stylistic rigor that you find in Fassbinder's work with the melodramatic material that he was attracted to after his exposure to Cirque. And I love many, many of his films. Fox and His Friends.
It's great.
Bitter Tears of Petra von Kant, Merchant of Four Seasons. But a cut above all of them has always been Fear Eats the Soul. So when it came time to pitch an idea, knowing that there's a fair amount of Fassbinder in the Criterion wheelhouse, I said let's do something with that. And so I kind of wrote a scenario for it, and we shot it in May. So it's for me, it's even I've had to go back and kind of revisit revisit it a little bit, but. But they, having seen what they did with all of it, I'm just really happy. It's been a great partnership with Criterion. And I think all three of us, David, Kristen, and myself, would say, you know, the wonderful thing is we feel like we have pretty good ideas, but they take what we give them and make us better, you know. That,
Like an editor, right?
I
get that.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
Exactly.
They make us, I would say they make us look smarter than we really are. But
I think you're doing all right. Yeah. So do you have a few others in the can? You probably can't reveal them, but I know you've personally done about three or four of these, right?
Right. This is my fourth. I don't have any others in the can, but there are some that were shot in a kind of whirlwind for David and Kristen. So theirs will be the next up. And I think we, you know, it's one of those things I have to start thinking about what I want to do for my next one. And I have...
I can't wait.
You've got suggestions?
I probably do, actually. We might get to a couple on the episode.
Right, okay.
So let's get right into Criterion stuff. So, okay, just this past week we had Meantime and Hopscotch come out. I would say they're good, but I wouldn't do an episode on those. And then we have La Poison and Sid and Nancy. Actually, hey, there you go. Sid and Nancy is a good music and film. Any thoughts on those? Well, I'll start. I feel like Jeff and I are dominating the conversation. So, Colleen, any thoughts on any of those four?
Well, Sid and Nancy, I feel like I have to give a shout out to that, given who I'm speaking to. Right? This is an Alex Cox loyalist, right?
He talked about it. Well, what's funny is he talked about it as he said that the Criterion DVD was better than any version that had ever come out. So I'll have to reach out again and see what he thinks with Blu-ray. Yeah. I have to imagine he probably likes it.
Yeah, I mean, anytime any of your films are entered into the Criterion canon, then I mean, it's an amazing honor, I have to think. And Sid and Nancy, you know, it's been a long time since I've seen that film, but at one point in my life it was very, very important to me.
Same here. And I'm curious I'm at a different point in my life now, so I might think a little differently, but
I like I remember the cameo from Courtney Love, who was originally going to play Nancy, and then they put her in there as a bit part. Yeah,
I'll have to look for that. I just remember the My Way, Gary Oldman, just iconic scene. That plays again.
It was a film important. It's interesting that to each one of us, it was an important kind of formative film. I saw it just before starting graduate school, actually. To me, it was kind of an instant classic.
Yeah.
I'm curious actually as to why Alex Cox felt the DVD was the best presentation. I mean, I saw it in theaters and I thought it was great
home media. He would definitely advocate for seating in theaters, but I think it might have been, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but he has plenty to say. He's a great guy, but anyway, I'm looking forward to him getting back. He has a couple others. Highwaymen, is that? I probably have that wrong, but I want to see, but they're just not available. So, again, he's a great combination of film scholar, irreverent personality, and really an academic, too, in a lot of ways. So, well, we also had the November announcements come out this week, so our listeners really like hearing about this. So we'll see what we can do.
Yeah, it's a solid list.
The first one, it's funny. Personally, I haven't seen a lot on this, but I saw your social media, Lady P.
Yeah.
So on November 7th, we have the Philadelphia Story coming out. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen it. It's a huge blind spot for me. It's been on top of the queue, but I just haven't got to it. But Pauline, did you, Kristen?
We sure did. Yeah. So I just moved into my new apartment in Madison, Wisconsin, and the film nerd equivalent of saging an apartment is to watch a Katharine Hepburn movie, right? I'm pretty sure. and so my new roommate mentioned that her favorite non-animated film is The Philadelphia Story. I am here to watch Katharine Hepburn. And, I mean, I'm on the record, I think, as loving Jimmy Stewart as well. So, and she is actually a strong Cary Grant partisan. So
that's going to be an interesting.
I know. Hopefully, we can bridge this
dorm
divide.
Fights about Stewart.
I know.
And Cary Grant.
We'll see.
So does it hold up in the dorm room experience?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, dorm. I say dorm room.
Sure.
You're in an apartment,
we are in a grown up apartment. Happy to say. I think it holds up under all contexts. It's just a great, fun, delightful movie. Obviously, the script it crackles. You know, so. Eternally quotable. I think, and it's perfect if you want to learn how to insult someone properly. Watch The Philadelphia Story.
Good. I
yeah,
need that.
Sure. Yeah.
Especially nowadays.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of new stuff, and so there's a documentary about Katharine Hepburn and her role in developing the film. And I was recently reading some other stuff about how she got involved, and as you know. not strictly producing, but how her behind the scenes influence and really her personality. She was a strong willed person, mm-hmm. and she would get things done. So I can't wait to see that in the documentary. Jeff, have you seen it?
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's a great, comedy from, you know, Hollywood's golden age. And of course I'm a big fan of Cary Grant and Jimmy Stewart. I probably would have to give like a slight nod to Stewart just, you know, on the basis of Vertigo as much as mm-hmm. anything else. Mm-hmm. But you know, Cary Grant, fantastic in Notorious and Awful Truth. Yeah. And so for me, if you, you know, put a gun to my head and say, is your favorite comedy of even Cary Grant's, I'd probably express a preference for Awful Truth, which I think is just a perfect movie.
That's great, yeah.
Just a perfect movie.
I always forget he's in that. But,
I've always liked Bringing a Baby mm-hmm. as well, which is kind of silly, but it's a good pairing. But, you know, Philadelphia Story is right up there for mm-hmm. me as well.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you didn't go Arsenic and Old Lace.
No.
I don't like that movie. I don't know why.
No, it's not done much for me either. It's
High five.
Yeah.
So on November 14th, we have Desert Hearts, ooh. Which is it's great female filmmaker and by Donna Deitch. And mm-hmm. this is from 1985. So it's sort of I was alive during that period. I was into film, maybe not this type of film. I don't remember it, but I'm really excited
how
to see
were
it.
You?
I saw the
I'm guessing you would have been a little bit young for this one.
I was 13.
Yeah,
so.
Well, you might have really enjoyed it then.
Missed opportunity.
Would have opened your eyes.
Have you seen it, Lady P?
I sure have. I love Desert Hearts. Yeah. I don't know. I don't. If my love of Carol is any indication, I might have a bit of a soft spot for this subject matter.
Sure.
I think it's a wonderful film. It used to be available on Hulu, and then it mysteriously disappeared, and you couldn't find it anywhere. So I was really delighted that Criterion has picked it for a re-release, because I certainly think it's worthy. And the name of the lead actress is escaping me now.
Helen Shaver.
Yes, and she has since gone on to become a director. She's directed a lot of television shows, but I think she's just wonderful. And as the lead, but it's, you know, it's a period drama set in Nevada, and the main character walks around like Kim Novak, so it's just like purposely evokes a lot of classic Hollywood stuff for me. So
that sounds
yeah,
fun.
Okay, yeah. I mean, I guess I can talk about what it's about, sort of dancing around it, but it's about a woman who goes to Nevada to get, and I believe it's the 1950s, she goes to Nevada to get a divorce from her husband. Mm-hmm. And she's a university professor from New York. And while she's on this, she ends up on this kind of dude ranch thing. And on the ranch is this young artist woman, and they fall in love.
Those young artist women.
You know, they get you every time.
They do. it looks like well, actually, Carol's a great comparison. That's kind of what you can never expect Carol, you know, that kind of caliber of a mm-hmm. film. That's setting the bar pretty high.
Sure,
but you know, anything near there, I'll be very happy mm-hmm. with. Have you seen it, Jeff?
Oh, yeah. Although I saw it it wasn't quite when it was released. I think I saw it when it came out on video in 86, 87. It was I don't think it had actually played the small town theaters that I was where I was living at the time. But it was one of those movies that generated a lot of buzz. So I, you know, when it came out on video, I made sure to see it there. And it's a very good film and historically very important film as well. We just had a defense of one of our dissertators who is writing about films that were more or less precursors to the new queer cinema that emerged in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. And Desert Hearts is one of those films, particularly because there was an early period where... in the early 80s with Personal Best, Cruising, Making That's Love. Right. Studios kind of just dabbled in making gay and lesbian themed work. But then it kind of, you know, they ran scared. It just didn't quite, you know, the controversy around Cruising certainly didn't help. But then the mid 80s, you saw independent films coming out and foreign films that made quite a big splash. And Desert Hearts was a part of that group. But almost all the other ones focus very much on gay male relationships. If you think of My Beautiful
Private Idaho.
So Desert Hearts has a kind of unique status in that regard.
Oh, sounds great. I can't wait. Well, also on November 14th, we have one that's a DVD release that's being upgraded that a lot of the community has been very vocal about. You know, pretty much this is the big sacred cow that has not been upgraded yet. So we have Jean-Pierre Melville's Le Samurai. Do I say that right? I never know how to say it.
That's the way I would say it. Yeah.
There's an AI. So I'm a huge Melville fan. I did some academic Melville research. Actually, an independent study about his resistance films and some other French films too. So of course, this is far from that. This is his gangster cool Alain Dion. You know, wearing a hat and I don't know how to describe that.
That's basically it. He wears a hat and a jacket, and he looks cool.
He's just cool, yeah.
Yeah.
It's been a while since I've seen that one. I've seen Army of Shadows a number of times. Again, that's Resistance, but I recently saw Le Cirque Rouge. But I do remember it as being the super, super cool, hip film, so I'm sure that's my take again. So, Jeff, are you a Melville fan?
Oh, absolutely. I kind of got into Melville, I think, as much as anything through Le Samurai.
Really?
Yeah.
Gateway.
It was kind of a gateway. Partly, you know, it's helped, of course, that Criterion has done great work in terms of bringing out editions of his films on DVD. But you know, I remember being David Bordwell's TA in the early 90s when he showed The Killer, John Woo's film, which, you know, at that time, nobody knew who John Woo was. David was, of course, very cutting edge when it came to Hong Kong cinema. So he was like, I'm going to show this in a class. And he rented a 35mm print. And knowing that Woo cited Le Samurai as a influence, I went and watched our, a group of us actually who went and watched our WCFTR 35mm print of Le Samurai. And so I was watching it on a Steam Deck, but you know, it was pretty, pretty cool.
Yeah.
And from that point on, I was sold. It was like anything I could see of Melville's he's right up there.
Mm. And, you know, I can't actually remember my gateway drug to Melville. It wasn't Le Samurai, but, you know, I think that would probably be a great one because I think it's probably the most accessible of his gangster films. I think maybe Army of Shadows is the deepest, I know that walks the tightrope. It's kind of gangster and resistance kind of embodies both. Do you like Melville? Lady P,
you know, it's very confusing. I know. I've only ever seen two of his films, The Samurai, that's what I'm going to call it, and Le Cercle Rouge. I have a lot of work to do as far as catching up on his filmography.
You're taking a French cinema class.
I know. It'll likely come up. It doesn't, like I said, it doesn't get much cooler than Alain Delon. How do you say his name? Alain Delon?
I struggle with his, too. Okay. I struggle with for being such a French aficionado, I need to brush up.
Sure, yeah.
Others that you should check out, definitely Bob Le Flambeur is fantastic. Yeah. As is, and my personal favorite is Les Doulos.
Okay.
Yeah.
Actually, I haven't seen that one yet.
Oh, it's...
A number of these are actually out of print. From Criterion. So Le Samurai, they still have the rights to. In fact, Le Cercle yeah. Rouge is gone, and Army of Shadows as well is gone.
Well, it's a wow. shame. I mean, my copy of Les Delos is actually a BFI print. It's Region 2. Yep. So I had gotten it before Criterion had decided, partly on the strength of one of my colleagues, who was a fellow graduate student at the time. Murray Smith wrote about it in his book Engaging Characters, and having read his discussion, I was like, I think I got to see this movie. And man, it's great. It is. I've used it actually in a class on film noir where, where you want to talk about, foreign language film noirs. I did a little unit where we, looked at a Nikkatsu film noir from the Eclipse set, and
that's a good one. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. That's a great set. I wanted to include pardon?
Oh, I was thinking Benders, The American Friend.
Yeah,
is a good,
American Friend is great. Yeah, as well. So I'm a big fan.
Cool. Well, Then on the 21st, so it's only four titles for November, although they have a pretty big title coming on just on the heels of that. But we have Terry Gilliam's Jabberwocky, and I'm surprised I've never seen this before. This was a staple on cable when I was growing up, back when I couldn't watch stuff like Desert Hearts. I could watch Jabberwocky, and I did watch plenty of other Gilliam and Python types of content. So I haven't seen this, and actually I kind of had forgotten about it a little bit. Of course, Gilliam's had kind of a up and down career. Apparently, he's finally making his Quixote film. But
good luck with that.
apparently, a wrap. So,
right.
I would guard those masters with their life. Have you seen it, Lady P?
I have not. I actually am not a big Gilliam fan. I've seen Brazil, 12 Monkeys. Some others, but they're escaping me now. But
Fisher King, maybe.
Maybe I haven't seen Fisher King. And that was one. I think when Robin Williams died, everyone was mentioning that, right?
It came out right about the same time. Time Bandits.
Right. Oh yeah, Time Bandits. Right.
Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Oh yes. Oh God, I don't like that movie at all. I mean, they're. They're very stylish, I'll say that. Oh, and I should... Well, obviously, I love Monty Python. But so Monty Python aside, I'm not I'm not a huge fan. But, I'm curious how they came upon this title. And I mean, is Brazil still in the Criterion Collection?
It is, and they have a few others. They did have the Fisher King and Time Bandits over the last couple of years. Okay. So,
and Fear and Loathing.
Fear and Loathing. That's going a little further back, but yeah. Terry Gilliam. He does have some art house sensibilities. He does have some fans, and they're a business too. They need to sell some discs.
So. Sure.
I wonder if they're trying to get what's his mid-80s film? Name escapes me. I'll look it up. Jeff, do you like Jabberwocky?
I have to confess, I think it's stumped the panel here. I have not seen Jabberwocky, even though it was kind of like prime. I was still in college when it came out, so exactly the kind of thing I can imagine myself going to, but I somehow just never saw it. I've seen lots of other Gilliam films. I mean, all the ones that Lady P mentioned as well, as some of the other ones that, I don't think, frankly, are very good, like The Brothers Grimm. Mm-hmm.
Zero Theorem is sketchy.
Pardon?
The Zero Theorem is pretty sketchy. It has good ideas, but bad exit. Yeah. He is up and down. The movie I was thinking was Baron Munchausen, which I think is okay.
Oh, yeah. I kind of like Baron Munchausen. Yeah, that's it's been ages since I've seen it. I might feel differently, but I remember enjoying it pretty thoroughly when I saw it.
Yeah, it has a lot of the Monty Python people and Uma Thurman, so yeah, that'll sell some discs.
He is responsible, though, I have to say, for one of my... I would have to say, most frustrating experiences of movie going. When I was in college, the Campus Film Society had announced they were going to show Monty Python and the Holy Grail. So I decided, oh, this would be great. None of my friends wanted to go, so I was going to go by myself. And
oh, boo.
In an even worse decision, I also decided to take a hit of acid. I thought, oh, this will be great, you know.
Wow, this is a podcast first, okay.
And it turned out to be one of the absolute most frustrating things, because very self-conscious about the fact that I was laughing about 4 seconds after everybody else was to every joke. And so then I spent most of the rest of it kind of with my hands over my mouth trying to restrain my laughter, because I was like, I still want to see this. But you know, I don't want to be the idiot that seems to be laughing at nothing. So,
well, all right, Jabberwocky might be a good candidate for this. So just try it at home this time. Yeah. All right. Well, and the next big one is the big one, the Spy 900, the 100 Years of Olympic Films. And so Matt and I already talked about this last week, and we went into quite a bit of length into this. And so Olympia and what else is? Yeah, Olympia is the big one, and then Tokyo Olympiad, and then there's a whole other 50-something of titles from a lot of different directors. So, Lady P, do you have any interest in Olympic films?
I mean, sure.
No, it's fine. A lot of people are not.
I mean, I'm. If you're asking if I'm going to rush out and purchase this, probably not. I mean, the packaging looks very impressive. It's going to be, if you put it on your coffee table, I'm sure it'll be a good conversation starter if you have any parties. I
can't wait for those parties.
Sure, yeah.
Let's talk some Riefenstahl kids.
Yeah. Exactly. but yeah, this is a big hulking thing. I would hardly know where to begin, to be honest. I mean, I've seen, I mean, yeah, yeah. this, I applaud them for putting this out. I mean, I guess, you know, you're sort of sales of Jabberwocky kind of finance big projects like this, right?
I think it'll do pretty well.
Yeah, okay.
And by the way, I did get a little scoop, too. They are going to try to get, overseas sale or different regions, and also some people were wondering if the Criterion logo is going to be on there, and that's a big deal to some people, and I guess me in a little a way, but yes, it will, but it was not on the image. So Jeff, Olympic films.
Well, I mean, for me, I suppose this holds interest because I remember all of those Bud Greenspan specials, which I loved when I was young. Yeah. So just purely kind of from a nostalgia perspective to see, old Olympic performances that I remember watching in the past, I think it would hit that, and I always loved the kind of Greenspan style. I prefer that actually, quite honestly, to the kind of typical Olympic coverage where, you've see some weightlifter out on a ranch somewhere, and it's kind of like those little personality puff pieces don't seem terribly interesting. I always thought Greenspan seemed to do better at capturing the kind of athletic competition and human drama. And it's tough to do. It's one of those things that, I had written new section of film art on sports films, which ended up being much, much longer than what you actually see in the in the final book.
I'm sure you have to cut a lot there.
Yeah. But some of it was just kind of going back. It's a genre which has produced a lot of films, but I don't think you can find a whole lot of great sports films. And some of it is that, one of the things that the documentaries can do is, everything is still kind of scaled in context. Most sports films to me always devolve on some kind of, you know, ridiculous implausibility in the game that turns everything around. And, you know, it's, so I guess
like the I was going to spoil The Natural. So no, but yeah, that's a good example though.
Yeah. It's one reason why I never understood why people like The Natural. To me, the whole thing is just a little too mythicizing, a little bit overblown. Give me John Sayles, Eight Men Out every time.
Oh, absolutely. Or, oh, know. Yeah. That's a good one.
Yeah.
Well, he'll be happy to know that a lot of the Greenspan films are on this set.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I would, made for someone like me who remembers as a teen watching Nadia Comaneci and Olga Korbut and Mark Spitz. Yeah. So long before
Phelps.
Yeah, long before Michael Phelps, Mark Spitz was.
I remember Mark Spitz and his bare chested medals.
Yes, yes.
It was everywhere when I was a kid. So.
Yeah.
Want to get into Filmstruck?
Sure.
Okay,
let's
so and Jeff, I don't know if you listened to the show or had a chance, but we just go through the week of Filmstruck just to see. It's great conversation starters. And your stuff, we talked about that. Hopefully we said good things. I'm pretty sure we said good things. So anyway, the main channel they just put out yesterday, they always put something out, a couple little groupings on Saturdays. And so the director of the week was this guy. Who, if you ever take the history of German cinema, Lady P, he'll come up. F.W. Murnau.
Him, yeah.
Yeah, that guy. I think he did some expressionism or something. Yeah, so great selection here. I haven't seen all of these, but everyone I've seen, I need to see City Girl. City Girl's been on my disc. Oh, by the way, Jeff, you get points for being region free.
Oh.
I have the... I think it's Masters of Cinema. So I'm sure we could talk about Murnau for five episodes, but Pauline, are
yes.
you big into Murnau?
Absolutely. Sight and Sound. Well, we had Sunrise, which I actually need to revisit because I don't think we were as effusive as we maybe should have been. but there's no question. I mean, he's a giant in films and, you know, the history of film. I mean, it's very exciting. This is a long time coming. It's great that people can now stream all these films. So
I know it.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm happy for everybody, but it's like, okay, well, you know, I had to go watch.
Yeah, I had to work for it.
Get off my lawn, people. So, Jeff, thoughts on F.W. Murnau?
Oh, well, I mean, I don't think there's a bad film in the entire, you know, career. They're all, they all have something, I think, to recommend them. So Nosferatu, obviously, a classic and one that had such reputation that I remember when Werner Herzog decided to do his remake of Nosferatu, you know, he described it as people had asked me, why would you ever, you know, bring Shakespeare to film? And it's like, why would you ever remake Nosferatu? I mean, the suggestion that it was as important as, you know, King Lear or something like that.
Mm-hmm. And 60 years later too, it's,
well, and 50, it's 50 years later, spawned its own, you know, kind of, what shall we say? Fan fiction in the form of Shadow of the Vampire, which which itself is a pretty good film as well. Mm-hmm. So, but you know, Sunrise is for me the you know it's one of the all time great movies.
Absolutely, I think of Murnau as one of the kind of directors that without him, film history could have gone a completely different way. And there's not many directors you could say. I mean, you could say Hitch. You could say, you know, John Ford, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, of course, I would say Renoir, but...
Yeah.
Let's not go there.
What's wrong with that? Yeah.
Well, there was another grouping, which was... This is why I love this. It's fun stuff. So they have one, How the Future Looked from the 70s, which, of course, well, you know, I just talked about 2001, which is almost the 70s, but not quite. And so they had World on a Wire... which fortunately doesn't look like that. Fantastic Planet, Rollerball, A Boy and His Dog, which I haven't seen, and Jubilee, which I haven't seen. I've had kind of mixed results with Jarman. So, yeah, how the future looked from the 70s. So, Jeff, did they get it?
Well, it's kind of like, an impossible task. I mean, I think this is the fun of doing something like this is, you know, we're just about to see Blade Runner 2049.
Yeah.
And that's because we're actually approaching 2019, which is the date in which Blade Runner is originally set. And somehow, thankfully, Los Angeles hasn't turned into the hellscape that we see.
Not quite.
Yeah. Still 2 years.
I used to live in LA.
Yeah. And I kind of welcome that sort of multicultural, you know, I don't know. To me, like, Los Angeles is becoming more sanitized. It's looking less and less like Blade Runner. But yeah. I not to be nostalgic for our dystopian future. But anyway,
I mean, the film that probably looks the most prescient at this point, I would say, is likely Rollerball. Mm. You know, because there is some sense of you know, corrupt media that's, you know, kind of still resonates with the sense that everything's kind of all fixed and, you know.
Yeah, a little reality TV, too.
Maybe. Yeah, a little reality TV to it. It's not quite Running Man, which is even more kind of anticipating reality TV. But I suppose I have a soft spot for Rollerball as well because our archive has a pretty substantial collection of materials related to its production. As part of our UA papers, there's a fair amount of stuff from Norman Jewison, who had, of course, been a kind of house director for UA through the 60s and into the 70s.
And there's also Fantastic Planet, which I think got it right. That's exactly how the world ended up. So then the Criterion Channel, actually speaking of Fantastic Planet, there was a short plus feature, so Six Men Getting Sick by David Lynch. Speaking of Twin Peaks, I didn't choose to watch this again because it is, as the title describes, and that's paired with Fantastic Planet. And boy, was there some vomit in Fantastic Planet? I guess there is, isn't there? I know there is bodily fluids, but I won't go into it.
Well, yeah, I remember John Waters, though, saying that this was in the 90s. He had come to campus and had given a public lecture, and he comes back to Madison pretty routinely. And he claimed that every great film has a puke scene in it. So
interesting.
Of course, John Waters said that.
And he said, I know what you're thinking. Bergman doesn't have puke scenes. I'm like, you're wrong. There are puke scenes in every Bergman film.
Interesting.
You know, now I'm going to be watching Bergman for puke scenes.
Oh, I can't vouch for the accuracy of this claim, but it was interesting. I started to think about it, and now it seems like every film I watch does have a puke scene, it seems. So
maybe it's non-diegetic puke.
Sure, yeah. Now that I think about it, I do think Philadelphia Story has a puke scene.
He's on to something. Yes. I think we just launched a new class, a new discipline.
So, but in some ways, you would say Six Men Getting Sick. This is like, you know, it's just
the greatest film ever.
This is like a crystallization of what every film should be.
And probably what John Waters plays at Christmas.
Sure, yeah.
And then we had our fun Friday double feature. And this is one of those weeks where I'm kind of striking out a lot. So I can't remember if I've seen The Preminger. So Daisy Kenyon.
Yes.
Preminger. Yeah. I don't think I've seen it. And then Sudden Fear. So this there's I guess a noir combo.
Yeah.
Have you guys seen this? Lady P?
This is my wheelhouse. This is, yes, I have.
All right.
I cannot recommend both films highly enough. They are essential. Daisy Kenyon, in particular, is, I would say, one of the greatest examples of classic Hollywood studio era modernism. In that it's about, it's like the quintessential 1950s psychological realism. And just dealing with the emotional fallout of adult characters and their their sort of psychological states in this more economically stable time. So Henry Fonda plays someone who lost his wife. He fought in the war. He comes home, and I'm forgetting the specific circumstances of how he became a widower. But it's kind of about his falling in love with Joan Crawford and how they kind of enter into this very mature adult relationship, knowing that they're, you know, the romance of their youth may be gone, but there's still so much left to salvage. And I think a truly beautiful film, and not enough people have seen it. And then Sudden Fear is a great San Francisco noir that features Joan Crawford sweatily running up and down the hills of San Francisco. It's an absolute must-see if you...
And also Gloria Graham.
And Gloria Graham, absolutely. We mustn't forget Gloria Graham.
I have to watch everything of hers.
Yes, so. There are rules.
Jeff, are you a big noir guy?
Oh, yeah.
I know the answer is yes.
Yeah, it's a course that... I kind of decided to teach in part because the Blacklist book, of course, looks at, you know, specifically anti-communist film noir, which I kind of treat as almost like a contradiction in terms, like Christian rock or something like that, you know. I've liked both of these films quite well. And I hope this isn't too much of a spoiler. I think the... images up on Amazon, but the cover of David Bordwell's new book on 40s Hollywood cinema features Sudden Fear as its cover.
Awesome.
So, nice. Okay.
So additional reason to. But he also writes about Daisy Kenyon, and, you know, having gotten an advanced peek at the book, it made me go back and rewatch it. And yeah, it is a surprisingly very... you know, mature film in some ways, in how matter-of-factly it deals with kind of, you know, issues of adult romance, including the lure of the bad boy. Yeah. And, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Premature. I love his Fallen Angel, and of course Laura. But I think a box set just came out recently with Daisy Kenyon in it. So I thought, okay, that's one I need to grab. Mm-hmm. But I've not got to it yet.
Well, Preminger is great. In fact, I would, for me, there are always films that, you know, like if I catch this, you know, midway through on like Turner Classic Movies, I can't stop watching it. Anatomy of a Murder is one of those titles. And the difficulty it's so good, but it's also like 3 hours long.
Yeah.
So, sometimes I have to just like ignore, I don't want to get hooked into this again, but I've seen it so many times. It is superb. And Preminger is just, you know, he's clearly part of the canon, but, you know, I think if you think about how much the Cahiers du Cinéma group and Andrew Saris kind of inflected the taste for the, you know, the Hawksaw Hitchcockians, right? Well, Preminger, I think, has tended to be a little bit overlooked, but I think he's as good, if not greater, than a lot of the people who have routinely spoken of as part of the canon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he does get overlooked a little bit. I thought that the Cahier group liked Bonjour Tristesse.
Oh, they did love Bonjour Tristesse.
Maybe I'm forgetting. But of course, he made Exodus too, so probably not up their alley. But so we also have they put out digital spines on Filmstruck, and I don't know if you're into these, Jeff or Pauline. Pauline, do you have Lady P? Do you have Filmstruck?
I do. Yes.
Are you going to keep it?
I hope.
A great resource.
Yeah. I found it very helpful. Just in researching for the podcast, and I imagine it will be helpful to have access to this library as I'm doing research. Although I'm also hoping that Madison has plenty of other means of finding films that I need to view.
I have a feeling they do.
Yeah.
I think they have all of them in the prints of them, probably.
Yeah.
But probably streaming services, too. They actually, universities pretty much have all the Criterion Collection these days. You probably could speak to that, Jeff.
Well, you know, I don't know that we have been exhaustively collecting. In part, the library probably has, but, you know, mostly we have a media center in which, you know, if we know that there's something that we'll have for instructional use, we purchase DVD copies just to, you know, to make them available. So much of what I deal with is through the media center, just because it's easier, you know, for faculty to work with that resource than it is to deal with the huge library system where, you know, something might be distributed in any one of four different places on campus that have DVDs.
Yeah, and I meant digital streaming. I think there's a few services that are rolled out to, I know, public libraries. We actually talked about that on the James episode a couple weeks ago. So
Know if we do have Filmstruck. I mean, it's certainly something that we have talked about, but
well, you're on it. I think you should get. That should be like the rule. If you're on it, you should have it.
Completely agree.
I'm calling Criterion, or actually TCM. I think actually manages that part. So
yeah.
All right. Well, we have a couple of digital spines. So Something Wild. Speaking of mid-80s. I guess hipster films are... It's not really hipster film. Why did I say that? Actually, I don't know what it is. But actually, a Pabst-influenced film. So Jonathan Demme came out. And also, again, speaking of vendors, we have a Buena Vista Social Club, which I just watched again earlier this year. And I kind of think that's a one-timer. But that's just me. So, Pauline, any thoughts on Something Wild?
You know, I have never seen Something Wild. I got to do that. I know.
You will see it for the contemporary film theory class. Yeah.
it has
promise of things to come.
It really has. It's really two movies in one. So I'm curious your takes. Maybe if you spin your classes to your podcast, I'll
It sounds like something I'd like. And Buena Vista Social. I mean, that's a great one. I love Inventors. But, you know, it's been a long time, and now that you say that, maybe I'm thinking it was a one-time movie. I didn't have that reaction at the time, but...
one-time movie, but a many times CD, streaming, whatever.
Right.
The album, but, and by the way, I didn't mean to imply that you'll like Something Wild.
Okay.
It's a bit divisive, but I think it's good. Jeff, any opinions on the two?
I've always liked Something Wild. It's... you know, it's for Demme, it's in a period where he really is making kind of movies that are a lot of fun. If you think of Melvin and Howard and Citizen Band and I would say Married to the Mob. I mean, there's a string where he finds these kind of quirky ways of approaching film genres and kind of jumbling them together. I mean, one of the reasons why it ends up getting taught in our contemporary film theory course is because Frederick Jameson uses it as kind of foil for Blue Velvet in his discussion of the nostalgia film, where he suggests Something Wild has a similar sort of, you know, ethos to it, in the sense of, you mentioned Pabst, you know, we've got a kind of Lulu-styled hipster character in Melanie Griffith. We've got our, you know, square-jawed yuppie in Jeff Daniels as our 80s figure. But, you know, elements of the plot seem to hint at 40s noir. Ray himself seems to be, you know, something of a kind of counterculture rebel coming out of the, you know, 60s or 70s. And Jameson's point, which I think is actually a good one, is instead of just homogenizing all of these different historical reference, Demme more or less puts them in dialogue with one another. And that's, so there's a kind of critical dimension to the film that Blue Velvet, for all of its sophistication in other ways, it doesn't really engage history in the way that something Wilde does. Now, it's a kind of depressing conclusion you come to, which is the conformity of the, you know, 1980s yuppie ends up driving out. Right.
But don't spoil it for Lady P. But look, it is. I do like it. I think I did a blog about it a few years back. But it's tonally, there's like a major shift. So and Ray Liotta is great. I think he was almost an unknown.
He was. It was kind of a breakout role for him.
Kind of a typecast in a way too, being the bad guy. But no, I mean, with a few exceptions. But
you could say that it isn't entirely a hipster movie. There are certainly hipster notes to it. When you have the Feelies playing for your, you know, your high school reunion,
right, yeah,
and they're great in the movie. You know, they're not playing own songs. They're playing, I think, Proud Mary and Fame, and just this kind of grab bag of stuff that it must have been fun for those guys to just, you know, pull out and play.
I love the Feelies. I love that I'm talking to a professor about the Feelies and dropping acid. And there are a couple other films that were added to Filmstruck this week. And actually, boy, I'm really striking out this week. So there was Avengers, Palermo shooting, and there's a David Lean, The Passionate Friends, which is one of the few Leans I haven't seen, and Shimizu, The Messieurs and a Woman. I think that's on the Eclipse set. And then All My Good Countrymen by Wojciech Jasny. So, Lady P, anything?
You got me. I don't know. I've never seen any of these. And then I love Avengers and David Lean. And I should be more familiar with Shimizu. Yeah. But
should I mean, it's great. One of those gaps. I've seen a couple of things, but I've not gone deep into the, you know, filmography.
Yeah.
And the Lean is like, it's right after, I think that's right after this Happy Breed, isn't it? And right around Brief Encounter.
So, yeah.
It's
a little bit later than Brief Encounter.
Wait, Brief Encounter was
45.
Was it?
Actually,
oh, okay.
Yeah. So a few years. But then he transitions, of course, but then to FX. So it's probably a good transition film. Maybe. I guess I'll watch it. So
we'll find out. Right, yeah.
Well, it's, I mean, Lean stuff in some ways, I kind of prefer that period to some of the later stuff as much as, you know,
absolutely.
Lawrence of Arabia is a, I had an assignment that I used in my contemporary Hollywood class that asked students to do a comparison between a post 1970 remake of a pre 1970 film. And one year I used two versions of Oliver Twist, the Roman Polanski version and the David Lean version. And reading then students' comparisons of these two films and how they, you know, they were asked to take the same scene and do a kind of compare and contrast with it. I started to think, man, I'm not sure I really believe I'm saying this, but I think Lean, at least when it comes to Oliver Twist, it's a better directed film than, even though I love Polanski, you know, I think he's one of the greats, but at least, you know, scene by scene basis, Lean was the better of the two directors. So it's kind of prime period for me for him.
I don't think you can be embarrassed saying that David Lean was a good director.
Yeah.
And actually, I forgot about those adaptations. So this The Passionate Friends was right after Twist and probably right after Great Expectations.
Yes.
So,
which
you could use that too as well for
absolutely.
A remake film. Again, the original is better. Spoiler alert for that class. All right. Well, this was the episode. So we just have our little pieces of flair, which Lady P, I kind of stole that from you, but it was really intended to be like just anything non-Criterion that's fun.
Sure.
So I'll let you go first. What's your piece of flair?
My piece of flair. Well, as I've mentioned, I haven't had as much time recently as I'd like to watch or consume any kind of media. It was my birthday a few weeks ago, and thank you. The thing that I did to celebrate was to go see a little movie called Girls Trip, which I'm going to be the one to bring up Girls Trip on a Criterion show. I'm just going to drop a little hint there.
Okay.
Criterion.
you have some inside info, or this is a strong suggestion?
I'd like to think that the Criterion folks would be open to having Girls Trip in their collection. And I really honestly think it's worthy. In all honesty, I do think that comedies often get overlooked, and comedies of a certain... they're usually, if they do make it, they're more cerebral, or they are directed by someone who typically makes more serious fare. But I think that Girls Trip succeeds, but in every measure that it sets out to succeed in. It's really funny, and the performances are all terrific, particularly Tiffany Haddish, who kind of steals the show. And if you're looking for a laugh, which I know I am,
we all need
a laugh. It is so very true. But it stars Queen Latifah and Jada Pinkett Smith, and I'm just here for the set it off reunion. and yeah, I can't believe I'm talking about Girls Trip on the Criterion Now show.
We went from Carol to Girls Trip. So.
but yeah, I guess that's the one. One recent release that really kind of struck me as being pretty terrific. I saw Baby Driver. I didn't love it.
I heard that.
Yeah, you know. So I think Girls Trip offers something for everyone. You know.
Okay. Well, I've heard good things. Okay. I've been very, very slack with new releases.
Sure.
So.
I'd be very curious to hear what you have to say about it.
Okay.
All right.
Well, I'll remember that.
Yeah.
We'll revisit this.
Okay.
Whether it comes out on Criterion or not.
Yeah. So.
Well, Jeff, what's your piece of flair?
For me, I hinted at it earlier. I think in terms of recent films, some of this may be that I didn't go in with the highest expectations, but I quite liked Atomic Blonde. To kind of describe it to someone, I would say, it's almost like a Bourne film, as though it were like put in a time machine back to the 1980s and directed by Tony Scott. Because it's kind of in the mold of Scott for something like The Hunger or Top Gun, where it's just very stylish. You know, it's great to look at, but it doesn't have all the bells and whistles that most later Tony Scott stuff has in terms of ramping and just kind of crazy text effects and all of that stuff, which I like too. But this was much more straightforward stylistically. And, you know, the other thing I would say to recommend it is if people like the way in which the action scenes are staged in the John Wick films. Director obviously has some background with that. This, I think, is even better in terms of there's a kind of set piece in the middle of the film that involves martial arts, gunplay, car chase. And it's all done really well. Including some pretty sophisticated computer work to make it all look like it's handled in a couple of very long, kind of seamless looking takes. And the way in which the director, I think it's David Leitch, right? Is the.
That sounds
Leitch.
Right.
Yeah.
There were two of them that directed John Wick. He was one of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The way he uses depth in some of these action scenes and stuff is much more sophisticated than the kind of just rapid cutting you get with, a lot of Hollywood action scenes in, Ridley Scott or certainly Paul Greengrass. Mm-hmm. So it's I suppose it's for that type of genre film, kind of espionage film. It's probably the best of its type that I've seen since The Kingsman. And I'm waiting for Kingsman 2.
Okay.
So.
I think there's something to be said for modern action. I think they're doing it pretty well. When we were in New York, we were trying to go to the Brooklyn Draft House and trying to find a good mainstream film. So this was playing, and then so was Baby Driver and Detroit, actually, which probably is not a good draft house film.
Yeah.
And we ended up not going to any of them. We went to Williamsburg instead, so which was not a bad. We had ramen. So
perfect. That is not a bad way to spend any evening.
Atomic Blonde, and this was the other one we almost went to. Even my wife is really into that, and she's not into action film or really interested. She's not into action films. So, my piece of flair. Actually, I switched gears. Just today, they announced the Arrow Academy releases, and I geek out to these Region B. Well, I geek out to physical media. Period. I do a podcast about it. So today they announced Sasha Guitry, four films from 1936 and 1938, and they're all four films. It's Let's Dream, My Father Was Right, Indiscretions, and Up the Champs-Élysées. So these are four I haven't seen, and I love Guitry in the 30s. And then they came out with another box set called Four Film Noir Classics, and I've been trying to pull it up. Their website's not the best. In the Dark Mirror, let's see, there's a Fritz Lang. In Secret Beyond the Door, Force of Evil, and The Big Combo.
Oh.
So, those are not like Preminger caliber noirs, but I guess lower tier, but good noirs, I think.
I would actually put The Big Combo up there with any of the great noirs. It is
okay.
Yeah, it's Joseph H. Lewis at his finest, and I mean, Gun Crazy is a pretty great noir to begin with.
Oh yeah,
but I think Big Combo is maybe a little bit better. I
sold.
I show clips of it in a course that I teach on sound because there is one just absolutely jaw-dropping sequence in which you have a character who is hearing impaired. Let's just say it's a rather poignant moment where he has his hearing aid removed. I don't want to spoil it, but okay. And the way that entire sequence is staged is just phenomenal. That those pools of darkness, suddenly a little cigarette lighter lights up, and you see characters in the background. It's all just wonderfully done, and it's just kind of a crazy movie to begin with. When I showed it last time in my noir class, a lot of students also really liked it because there's kind of it goes beyond homoerotic subtext to the two of the kind of henchmen that there seems to be hinting, even in 1955, at a kind of, love relationship between these two characters. And students really kind of picked up on that and were surprised at how kind of frank it was.
Mm. Was The Big Combo on Filmstruck? A few, it may have expired, but I feel like it was recently on Filmstruck.
It's
I could be making that up.
I would be surprised, actually, because okay. Olive came out with an edition not too long ago.
Okay.
So.
I remember seeing it on some streaming service.
It may have been on there, but I'm thinking Filmstruck is too recent that the Olive edition has been out, I think, prior to the launch of that service.
Okay. So. Yeah.
Okay. Well, sometimes they get little short licenses, but I don't recall that. But anyway, I'm going to buy the box set.
Sure,
anyway,
and
by the way, people, as far as I know, I think these are all Region B releases. I think the Guitry might be Region A because I don't think anybody has a right seat. Oh, and they also came out with Departures, which is a pretty good music film. So all right, well that's it. So thank you so much for joining us, and. Thank you for planning your life around my podcast.
Nice timing, huh? How about that? Yeah. Move to Madison just for you.
I appreciate it. Well, you're living my dream just for me, so thank you for that. In fact, just bring your podcast recorder into class.
Sure.
So, Lady P, where can people find you online?
Well, I guess you can find me on Twitter. The handle is at FlixWise, which is the podcast, which I don't think I've actually mentioned. I host a podcast called FlixWise when I'm not on show. Yeah, that's okay. My bad. We go through the top 200 films on the Sight and Sound Critics poll. Although at the rate we're going, who knows how far we're actually going to make it? But
going to grad school,
yeah.
You got Satan and Tango out of
that. That's true. So. That was a chunk. Sailing. Yeah. Yeah.
You haven't done Greed yet, though.
Greed. Yeah, and I don't know. Actually, know how I'm going to find Greed. Yeah, there are a couple of them where it's like, this might have to wait.
Because that's somebody needs to put Greed out. But
that's a whole other thing. Yeah, yeah. But you can find us. It's on iTunes. Again, that's FlixWise, or we have a website, FlixWise.com.
Yeah.
If you like this show, chances are you're a film nerd, and you might be looking for more content. And
I know just from talking to people that when our show gets mentioned, FlixWise is always right up there.
I
vouch for it. I've been on it a couple times.
I think you're overdue for another appearance.
I might be. I did my second podcast, my first from here, so on FlixWise, and I was very, very hurt.
That's right. We kind of. Watership Down fans may be a little disappointed.
Oh, yeah, don't listen to that. Because people will hate Martin. I think he's walked that one back. But don't listen. Well, it's a great podcast, but I was on pain meds. And
oh, God. Oh, that's right. Yeah, no, you were great. Yeah.
Okay. Jeff, where can people find you online? Or do you want to be found online?
Actually, I'm someone who I don't have a very strong social media presence. So probably the best place to find me would be on the Communication Arts website. But of course, you can find my email and all of that information there.
You are on Filmstruck.
Yeah, although that's pretty much one-way communication. They can hear me, but I can't hear them. So
it's for the best. but
I don't know if you want to invite that.
Yeah.
I don't have a Twitter account. I have a Facebook page, but I think the last time I posted something on my Facebook page was probably 2012.
So nice.
Yeah, ending you again.
Yeah. I'm lucky that I have people to kind of, take care of this stuff for me. Yeah.
You have your Facebook henchmen.
Yes, I do.
Well, we're at the Criterion Now Facebook group, and so find us there. We're also on Criterion Cast on Twitter and on Facebook, and on the Criterion Cast master feed. So you can find me, AWest505, and I'm just tweeting all about politics these days.
Yeah.
A lot about politics.
It's important,
Some film. Yeah, somebody's got to do it.
Yeah.
No, there's not enough of that.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
So, all right, thank you so much for joining us. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you
for
having
us.
Thank you.